From the Sky News Centre at 6, BA's boss has accused the Unite Union of trying to break the airlines through strikes. Cabin crew will walk out for 3 days from March the 20th and for 4 days from March the 27th in protest at cost-cutting plans. The airline says it's drawn up plans to cope. A member of cabin crew we've spoken to asked us to conceal his own voice.
It's very nerve-wracking to ballot to go on strike, but to actually go on strike and withdraw your labour, the serious implications it has not only on the staff throughout the airline and including the cabin crew themselves. I believe that it's a strike that nobody wants. I believe that we would like a negotiating settlement, and I believe we've been left with no other option.
A man who starved a seven-year-old to death because he believed there were evil spirits inside her has been jailed indefinitely. By the time Kyra Ishak was found at her home in Birmingham in 2008, she'd lost about 40% of her body weight after suffering at the hands of Junaid Abu Hamza's punishment regime. Kyra's mother got a 15-year sentence. The girl's father, Abu Zair Ishak, believes the couple's mental illnesses are no excuse.
They were aware of their actions. They knew what they were doing was wrong, and therefore, that's inexcusable.
Police say the father of a five-year-old boy kidnapped in Pakistan last week is helping officers find his son. Raja Nakash Saeed is back home in Oldham and working with police to ensure Sahil's safe return. The BNP has been forced to rewrite its constitution after a judge ruled its new membership rules discriminated against non-whites. The far-right party was ordered to close its membership list until it complies with race laws. The House of Lords is to investigate Baroness Udin's expenses claims. The Crown Prosecution Service announced earlier that no criminal charges would be brought against the Labour peer. Michael Jackson's UK home is being recreated for fans with pieces of furniture he personally commissioned going on display. The exhibition's taking place at a museum in County Kildare. The items include a 16-foot red velvet sofa. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
It seemed too good to be true.
A flight leaves on Monday.
10 weeks making a difference in countries like South Africa, India and Peru.
They need a block of toilets building for their village.
Thousands of 18 to 25 year olds from the UK.
And I don't have to pay for the flights, food, accommodation, vaccinations.
What? How do you manage that? Who pays?
Platform 2. Volunteering abroad for 18 to 25-year-olds who've always wanted to help out overseas but couldn't afford it. Funded by the Department for International Development. No need to use life savings or have rich parents. If you're 18 to 25 and have or are eligible for a UK passport, go to myplatform2.com or phone 0800-988-6828.
Wow, myplatform2.com or 0800-988-6828.
It's no movie fantasy. Platform 2, your platform to change your world.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. Who is attacking our civil liberties? Is it terrorists or the government or both? We'll be looking at that in a minute with Drive Time's Richard Cowley. But first, Marina Morris is with me to complete our report we were having on assisted suicide. Marina.
UK's assisted suicide. The commentators debate about the new policy on prosecuting assisted suicide. The Independent editorial considers the possibility that clarifying the law will do more harm than good. The lawyer Samita Shail says in Guardian she welcomes the new guidelines but sees some loopholes. English bishops are united against the legalization of assisted suicide. The Times editorial says the debate is not over but calls the amendments a form of wisdom. The Telegraph editorial says the changes were made through the judicial backdoor and should go through the parliament. Euthanasia has been decriminalized in a number of European countries, namely the Netherlands, Belgium and Switzerland. Additionally, the US state of Oregon has a Death with Dignity Act and Australian the Northern Territories rules. If Tony asked me my opinion about suicide, I think life is special every second. Who should play God? What happens after death? What we need to address is the cause, not the effect, and to work towards improving health span. And finally, very briefly, UK's asylum seeker suicide. 55 asylum seekers, migrants in the UK, have taken their own lives since 2000. 10 in immigration removal centres, 8 in prisons, 18 vulnerable people in state care, and 37 in the community. Last Sunday, 7th of March, a Russian family jumped to their death from a Glasgow tower block. Sergei Serukh, 43, who along with his wife and stepson was convinced that if he was not given asylum in Britain, his life would be at risk. It's all about assisted suicide in Britain.
I would also mention that there's been some very interesting investigative reports into the company Dignitas in Switzerland that's been doing some of them. Not, they don't come out of the investigations very well, I can tell you that. If anyone wants to go onto the internet and look up this company Dignitas, which is doing assisted suicides in Switzerland. Martin, you're with us. Before we hear Marina's Vox Pops this week, what are your thoughts about the whole business of assisted suicide?
Well, I probably agree with what Alex said before the break, which is that under the right conditions and with lots of safeguards in place, people ought to be able to end their lives at a moment of their choosing rather than as a moment of their illness's choosing.
Okay, let's see what you think, though, because, as I said, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you what you think about this whole issue of assisted suicide.
Does the law need to clarify the position of assisted suicide? And is it open to abuse?
I think that each individual should have the right to determine if their mental state is sufficient to decide their future. And if they think that their life is not worth living, it should be their right to decide to end it. It's open to abuse because unscrupulous relatives may possibly influence someone who is in that position.
Do I agree with it? Yes. Well, if somebody wants to end their life, they should be entitled to do it. That's their life, and it's their decision. You know, you've got to draw the line between where somebody wants to go themselves or where somebody wants to dispose of somebody to get rid of or to get a bit of money out of it, like, you know. So that's where you've got to be a bit careful, haven't you? There's got to be laws.
No, I don't agree with it, really. I think once you start on that path, then you could go, you know, the following year there'll be something else and then something else and it could escalate.
The partners and loved ones of people that choose to end their lives can be prosecuted even if they go abroad, and it needs to be clarified in the sense of making sure that they're free from prosecution in the future if other safeguards have been met. Well, if you think it's a basic human right to choose when you live and when you die, then whatever category society seems to deem you're in or out shouldn't really be affected. I mean, with certain groups, like the people who are learning disabled, or it may be more difficult to ascertain degenerative brain disease, you know, it'll be hard to determine what their true feelings are. So I think there'd have to be safeguards in place. But no, I think it should be an inalienable right.
Potentially there's sort of always potential loopholes with these things, so I could imagine that, yeah, some, depending on the particular case, there is potentially ways that people can assist people to commit suicide that isn't illegal, whether that's sort of leaving things for people to kill themselves if they have that ability. I think most of the publicised cases are where people aren't in a position to commit suicide, and then they're asking for help.
If you were suffering with a terminal illness, would you consider a right to euthanasia?
I'd consider it. Whether I do it is another thing. I can't say in my present state of mind, I can't say I'd do this or do that. I would consider it.
I wouldn't myself. No. Not if it was me. Because I believe what God got in store for me, he got in store for me. So should I have to suffer a terminal illness for 10 years?
Yeah.
And so be it.
It's difficult to say because I think it depends on what sort of illness it is and how painful it is and things like that. I would only really know at that time, you know. I think there are different times you can't really decide beforehand.
Well, yes. It would be one of my options and I would certainly consider it.
If I was to get to a position where I had been in an accident and I was sort of either terminally or sort of heavily disabled, I don't know, I'm sort of married, so you'd hope that I'd still be looked after and loved, and if it felt that I wanted to kill myself, then I don't know, maybe my view on assisted suicide would be sort of swing one way.
That was the people of Bristol speaking to Drive Time's Marina Morris earlier this week about the whole topic of assisted suicide. Martin, again, can you just round up your thoughts on the subject?
Well, as I said earlier, in my view, with the correct safeguards, I think we should effectively allow assisted suicide. In practice, that's what happens anyway. Doctors end medication. They play around the rules as they exist at the moment. I think perhaps we need clarification, because we do need to protect against the removal of people that people find awkward or difficult, and it should never be forced on anybody that they should take assisted suicide as a way of making life easier for others. It must be very, very robust, the protection against that, if you're going to have such a regime.
Well, what about something as simple as the fact that sometimes people have a low day, and on that low day they may agree to something that maybe a week later they're not.
Well, that's precisely why. That's precisely why you'd have to have safeguards. They wouldn't just have to agree.
How can
with
you safeguard
one day.
That, though? I mean, if someone is actually deciding.
Well, I mean, let me put it to you this way: I've seen relatives and friends of mine die over a long period when they would certainly have been better off to have died earlier rather than later.
But is that your decision?
No, it's their decision. That's the point. And of course, there is an issue whether people are capable of making such a decision when they are perhaps mentally ill or in other circumstances of that kind. And that's why you have to have absolutely strong safeguards to protect individuals from being bullied into the wrong decision. But nevertheless, I think it should be an option in the long run for us, especially as Marina pointed out, that people now have 16 years potentially of illness to put up with at the end of their lives. People used to just die of their illnesses. Now we keep them alive. I mean, all we've got to do is go back to what we had 20, 30 years ago, where people just died because they couldn't be kept alive. And then we would have assisted suicide by the back door, if you like. That's how it always used to be. People retired at age 65 and they were dead by the age of 70. That was assisted suicide. It was just we didn't call it that.
But the worry here, of course, is that with a very ageing population and money too tight, isn't it possible that there are going to be financial motives?
Absolutely,
here?
And if the financial motives are brought into play, then that's what what safeguards must be there to protect against. That's a very severe worry. I mean, if you were going to write legislation to allow this, you'd very much have to safeguard against people being bumped off for financial reasons.
Okay, well, we'll be going on to look at some more investigative reports in a little while, and some of the stories that we didn't cover in the first hour, as well as our report into the Inquiries Act 2005 by Richard Cowley. But first, let's have some music. On the week that Bristol was declared the most musical city in Britain.
And by whom, Tony?
I think it's by the Performing Rights Society. Just okay. Literally looking at how many musicians we have in the city per head of population. And we are number one. We are top. And even Liverpool, you think would be a very high up city, is something like 18th down the road. So I think we've really got to find a good bit of music to celebrate the fact
that Bristolian music?
I don't think it's actually Bristolian. No, this music, what I'm going to put on now, is in fact from Norway. And it's from a group called Røyksopp, and it's called So Easy.
Oh, community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
That's Roy Ksopp, spelled R-O-Y, and the O has got one of those funny little things on the top of umlaut or something, but they're from Norway, R-O-Y-K-S-O-P-P, and that's So Easy, based on an old song called Blue on Blue from the year 1999. Now, Martin, we've had one of the stories we didn't cover in the first hour was this whole business of bailiffs being sent to evict Bristol Tesco squatters at Jester's Comedy Club. I don't know if you've been past there. Have you had a look?
No.
Anyway, bailiffs were on Tuesday sent to evict squatters who took over a former Bristol comedy club in protest at plans to turn it into a Tesco supermarket. Bailiffs visited the site of former Jester's in Cheltenham Road, Stokescroft, to evict squatters who were protesting on the roof of the building. Now, I was quite amused to hear on Tuesday that Radio Bristol actually reported that the squatters had been evicted and then had to backtrack because they haven't, and they're all still in there. Another rather worrying aspect to all this is that we've had several attacks on other Tescos around the town. And I'm not quite sure why. Apparently, on Monday night this week, something I've not seen in any of the other news coverage, Tesco frontages were smashed in Redfield, Fish Ponds, Gloucester Road and Broadmead. So it seems like there's some sort of a concerted campaign here, really, to intimidate Tescos out of the area. The trouble is, of course, that the local people around Cheltenham Road are, it seems, very much in support of the squatters, saying that they really don't want a Tesco's there. This is you know the part of Cheltenham Road I think we're talking about here, Martin, do you?
Yeah.
Just up from Ashley Road. There isn't really anywhere for anyone to park there, is there? So I suppose I'm hoping that the only people using that Tesco will be people who are coming to it by foot.
Yeah, but of course it's, the potential is to destroy all the other little shops further up Cheltenham Road and further up Gloucester Road. That's what a supermarket might do, isn't it?
But there's nothing that politicians or city councillors or whatever can do about this, is there?
Well, I mean, we need to start thinking about what sort of urban space we want, and we need to make plans to have the urban space we want rather than just letting developers have ride roughshod over local feeling.
So how do you do that, though, practically? I mean, there's not really a lot that can be done.
Well, the planning law, by and large, favours the developer, as we all know. Perhaps there need to be changes in planning law.
Okay. What do you do? Are you a Tesco shopper yourself?
Not really, no. I live on Stapleton Road and there are plenty of nice little shops for me to use there which are privately owned.
But I bet if there was a Tesco's next door to you, you'd been there all the time, Martin.
No, I think the shops over the road from me are as cheap as any supermarket, frankly. And I think that there's no call for a supermarket on Stapleton Road.
But do you think it'll work? The tactics of actually destroying the frontages of other Tesco's?
Well, let's not jump to conclusions about what's happened there. I would suggest that that's not a legitimate way to pursue your political protest, whatever it is. Squatting is legal, which is why they're still in there, because the natural. In fact, they've got a right to squat and they have to be evicted properly by the court.
When the bailiffs and police turned up on Tuesday, apparently they did decide that it was actually not practical to evict them.
Yes, and there's a whole procedure you have to go through to evict people who are squatting, and there are rules and regulations which all squatters who are serious know. That's if you're going to use the rules on one hand, you can't say, well, we're not going to play by the rules on another hand. You've got to use the rule book. It's what used to be called being a barrack room lawyer.
Now, we talked about this story probably a month ago or so, just after it was first squatted, this building. Do you think this is going to rumble on and on and on, this one? I mean, I was going past there yesterday and I see that some of the squatters are putting tripods up on the roof, for goodness sake, to make it, I suppose, if the place is there's an attempt to evict the place, that the squatters will climb up these gigantic great scaffold poles and be completely invulnerable to the police and bailiffs.
Well, I mean, these kind of protest tactics are well tried and tested. Whether it will ultimately stop Tesco's building a store there is another matter. I mean, that depends upon the general rules and regulations and planning laws. people are, in my view, are entitled to adopt non-violent protest tactics to oppose things that they don't like.
But
as long as they don't hurt anybody.
Attacking property, is that a part of the legitimate thing?
Well, you could argue that smashing windows isn't violent, but I suggest that the people who use those existing stores wouldn't see it that way. And if you want to build support in the community, that might not be the way to go about it. Let's put it that way.
I mean, I can remember when I lived in Bedminster years ago, seeing the front of the Abbey National had been completely smashed, I would imagine, by some sort of disgruntled customer who'd had their house repossessed or something.
Yes, but if you remember back to the co-mutiny protests in Bristol some months ago, people were throwing custard pies at the banks and doing all sorts of naughty things, but they weren't breaking anything and they weren't hurting anybody. And I think that that's a very important line not to cross. I mean, lots of breaking glass flying over the place, somebody could get hurt. That's stepping over the line in my view.
Okay, another story. Jordan's King is telling Joe Biden, who's the American vice president visiting Israel at the moment, that the settlements are threatening peace. Although Joe Biden has been over in Israel trying to, I imagine, do some diplomatic work towards a peace settlement, it seems that it's rather unfortunate that his visit has timed to coincide with the announcement of a whole load of new Israeli settlements being built in East Jerusalem, which is a predominantly Arab area. What are your thoughts about the timing of this announcement by the Israelis?
Well, I mean, people in Israel itself are saying that Netanyahu has been extremely rude to Joe Biden to allow this extra settlement decision to come through while he was in the country. The US, in theory, is opposed to extra settlements. What the Israelis seem to be doing is rubbing the world's nose in their defiance. And that, of course, has not pleased the US administration.
Okay, I've got a little song for you now, Martin. I'm playing this one specially for you. All it's right. By a group called Stereolab. And Stereolab were around in the, I think, mostly mid and early 1990s. The reason I've chosen it is because it's a particularly economic song. It's all about the whole thing of boom bust. And what I love about Stereolab's approach to the subject is the way that they treat it in such a sort of jaunty fashion. And they, even if the mainstream media in this country can't make the connection, they have very much made the connection between economic boom and bust and war. So let's have a little listen to a song called Ping Pong. I imagine ping is boom and pong is bust, I imagine, or something like that, by Stereolab from 1994.
Back to square one, back.
Stereo Lab there from 1994 with Ping Pong. What do you think about the lyrics there? They're basically having a sort of a laugh and a joke with this whole idea of the economic cycle, aren't they?
Yeah, and in the 1990s it was a laugh and a joke, but this time less so.
Well, I think that what they're saying is that there's some sort of that it is all a little bit ridiculous, the way that we're asked to believe that the economic cycle simply goes up and down and up and down. And one of the things that always fascinates me about your take on all this, Martin, is that it may just go down. It may not come up again.
That's right. I mean, the presumption that things are going to be tomorrow the same as they were yesterday is just a presumption. Once you get yourself into the kind of hole we're in now, it's not at all clear how you get out of it.
Well, as I said at the beginning of this hour, I'm just having a little look now at the article in today's Daily Mail about Princess Diana, who was apparently, according to Michael Mansfield, killed after a plan to frighten her went wrong. Now, this is by the Mail Foreign Service in the Daily Mail today. Princess Diana died after attempts to frighten her into dumping Dodi Al-Fayed and ending her anti-establishment activities went horribly wrong. Michael Mansfield claimed he was sure Diana's killers had no intention of ending her life in the Paris tunnel in August 1997 and simply wanted to scare her. But he claimed the operation to torpedo her relationship with Dodi and silence her planned criticism of the British government over foreign arms sales backfired spectacularly. But this plan went very badly wrong and ended with her death, he said. The radical QC, Mansfield, whose long list of famous cases has included the Bloody Sunday inquiry, the Jean-Charles de Menezes inquest, has previously claimed Diana's road crash death was no accident. He outlined his views in memoirs published last year on his colourful 40-year career. His latest comments on the tragedy were made during a trip to Barcelona. A jury concluded that Diana had been unlawfully killed in April 2008 after a six-month inquest at the Royal Courts of Justice. It blamed the grossly negligent driving of her chauffeur, Henri Paul, and chasing paparazzi photographers. Mohamed Al-Fayed, who told the inquest Diana was murdered in a conspiracy involving Tony Blair, MI5, MI6, and the British ambassador to France, not to mention the Duke of Edinburgh, has always refused to accept the verdict. In an interview with Catalan daily El Periodico, published today, Mr. Mansfield said British authorities oppose several aspects of Diana's private and public life. He said, "I believe the relationship between Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed displeased the authorities. In spite of all the work Mohamed Al-Fayed did for children and hospitals, he was persona non grata in Britain, and some of that argue probably still is. As far as Diana was concerned, she had given interviews attacking the royal family for the way they treated her, but I think that what most annoyed the authorities was that Diana became very actively involved in the campaign against landmines. The UK arms sales industry is huge. It's one of the biggest three in the world. The investigation into Diana's death showed she was preparing to denounce British complicity in the sale of weapons to countries that do not respect human rights." Can I just get your comment on that, Martin? Do you think this is all pie in the sky stuff, or do you think that there is a chance that the British establishment, or at least elements within it, had it in for Diana?
Well, there's a chance, but of course it's very hard to get to the bottom of incidents like this. We've got David Kelly patently did not commit suicide, so we've certainly got cases where this has happened in the past, so maybe it did take place in this case as well. We just don't know, do we?
Certainly Norman Baker's book on the death of David Kelly does make it pretty clear that it does look like he was murdered, but anyway, these things are very difficult, because after there's been an inquest, the temptation is just to say, well, let's forget about it.
That's right.
And so should we?
No, I mean, inquests are flawed for reasons which we're probably going to discuss in a moment, I believe. Inquests often are used to cover up the truth rather than to get to the bottom of the truth. That's one of the problems with inquests.
Well, yes, and then the way the law works, at least it's the way it's supposed to work, is that the Coroner's Acts have always said that, well, if you have one suspicious death, then there's an inquest into it, conducted by the coroner. If you have multiple deaths, as we have in many cases, for example, such as the London bombings, which we'll be looking at in a moment, the idea is to have a public inquiry. But things have changed a lot, because in 2005, there's a whole new way of conducting inquiries proposed was brought in. And I'm joined now by Richard Cowley, who's in the studio, and he's here to talk about this Inquiries Act 2005. Maybe I can just start by asking you, Richard, how did you come to this subject? What was the reason that you decided to have a to have a look at it?
Well, I don't know exactly. It's a long time ago now. But
well, you were talking last week, for example, about about Northern Ireland, and
it's to do with ethics, essentially, and the morals of the question. You know, we're being scared and kind of bullied rather regularly by typical Princess Diana sort of position, where we find ourselves consistently having to be more loyal and cross-examine our own standards, morals, positions in conjunction with our loyalty to military service, which is a very big question, especially in terms of the Foreign Office and other commitments abroad. The Home Affairs, for example, what happens in the national area is a separate issue, and that often aggravates the other. So it's very difficult in this omnivorous kind of world to make sense of black and white issues.
But isn't that the whole reason why we have inquests and we have inquiries?
Speaking about, you know, inquests and secret inquests, for example, I have in front of me a piece of paper off the net recently downloaded where it says controversial plans to hold some inquests in secret have been recently abandoned by the government because of a lack of support. Jack Straw, the Justice Secretary, yesterday confirmed that he was dropping those particular plans. This was actually dated 16th of March 2009. There are some inquests that, for example, might be replaced by instead public inquiries, which would allow some details to be kept secret if they involve sensitive information. So it's at the government's discretion. So you could say that the power to hold an inquest involving issues of national security, etc., or for the public's benefit, behind closed doors and without juries, was contained in the Coroner's and Justice Bill currently going through Parliament. An example, for example, would be friendly fire, military casualties, or cases similar to the death of, say, weapons expert Dr. David Kelly, as previously mentioned. So the big problem now is that the recent Inquiries Act 2005 can be substituted for this other act, for the act that I've just mentioned. In conjunction with secret inquests, you could have a secret inquiry using the other act, for example.
Now, this is a bit worrying. I know, certainly from my point of view, I first came about across questions about the Inquiries Act 2005 in a internet documentary, which is half an hour long, which is looking at the 7/7 London bombings, because of course one of the big problems with that is that there still hasn't been a proper public inquiry into what happened that day. I'm just going to play you now a quick extract from the film Ludicrous Diversion, where they talk about and question who it is that's really attacking our civil liberties.
But ironically, it's not the terrorists attacking our way of life, but our own government. Through the expansion of police powers and stringent anti-terrorist measures being imposed upon Britain, they are using our fear for our safety to restrict our liberty, and they are using their false promises of security to erode our privacy. This is happening now, and it's happening to every person in the UK. You are not somehow exempt from the regulatory provisions of the new police state being brought into this country. The terrorists cannot take away our freedom or change our way of life. Only our own elected leaders can do that. And they are.
That's an extract from Ludicrous Diversion. Martin, what are your thoughts on the idea that actually it's the government that's taking away our civil liberties, not the terrorists?
Well, perhaps there's no distinction between the two. As we discovered in Northern Ireland, the state was involved in terrorist activity, but through police investigation. I mean, what worries with the 2005 Inquiries Act is it's basically watering down inquiries, so that in actual fact they can be held in secret. They're not actually going to be able to do the job that they were originally designed to do. And in Ireland, of course, the Pat Finucane Centre, which is a kind of a legal pressure group, if you like, they want an inquiry into the collusion surrounding the murder of Pat Finucane and other incidents that took place in Ireland, but they don't want it to be run by the British government because they don't trust the inquiries to be independent. And I noticed from what you were saying earlier, Richard, that it looks as if the Bloody Sunday inquiry is about to report after all these years of investigation now.
Yeah, that's right. The Savile, as they call it, the Savile Inquiry, has been running for some time, since about the year 2000, and it's cost approximately £200 million, which is rather extravagant. It's about to be released on the 22nd of March this year, so they say, but because of the elections coming up, they might run into what I think they call a PUDA.
PURDA.
In which case, that will be even longer before the results are finally heard, but at least it is going to be heard within the next month anyway. And anyway, can I just say something about the last point that Martin made? Because I've got in front of me another download, which is a quoted bit of material, where Tim Hancock, which is the campaign's director for Amnesty International UK, is quoted as said that it's worrying that the government may still try to keep families and the public in the dark by using the Inquiries Act 2005 instead of having an inquest under the usual conditions. And under this Inquiries Act, the government can control who sits on an inquiry. It can order part of the inquiry to be held in private, and it can decide which of the findings are published and which remain secret. So, if secret inquiries are dropped but replaced by the Inquiries Act 2005, this climb down may do little to increase government transparency.
It seems to, this Act, 2005 Act, seems to have muddied the waters. It may possibly have been better to leave the situation as it was before, with an ordinary public inquiry, which is certainly where the panel is organised by the judiciary rather than the government, and also where it's not held in secret. Anyway, I'd just like to play a little bit now from the Ludicrous Diversion film, which just focuses on what exactly the Inquiries Act 2005 says.
If you have examined any of the information released about the attacks of the 7th of July, or if you get your news from a reputable source, i.e. one outside of the mainstream media, then you probably are one of those advocating an inquiry into the London bombings. We suggest you stop wasting your time. Why? Because full public inquiries are not full, and they're not public. These terms are used simply to delude us into thinking that the process of an inquiry is intended to uncover the truth about something. This is simply not the case. Let's recall the last major public inquiry held in the UK. The Hutton Inquiry, set up to investigate the apparent suicide of Dr. David Kelly, with a side mandate of examining whether the government manipulated intelligence to facilitate the invasion of Iraq. Given that Hutton was appointed by Lord Faulkner, the very man who continues to declare that the Iraq invasion was somehow legal, it is unsurprising that Hutton absolved Blair and his government of blame. The inquiry refuted allegations that the government had lied about information on Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, something that any rational person doing an hour of research can see clearly that they did. And more incredulously, Hutton ruled that Dr. David Kelly committed suicide, despite all the physical and medical evidence that clearly points to him having been murdered. But it gets worse. As if public inquiries were already not pointless enough, a recent piece of legislation now guarantees that they will never be anything other than a charade. On June the 7th, 2005, exactly 1 month before the London bombings, the Inquiries Act became law. Under this new act, any inquiry will be controlled by the relevant government minister who is empowered to block public scrutiny of state actions. This inexplicable change to the way inquiries are run was openly criticised by the Law Society of England and Amnesty International, who stated that the new act means that any inquiry will be controlled by the executive. Obviously the one thing you don't want from a supposedly unbiased investigation. The Canadian judge Peter Corey stated, "It seems to me that the proposed new act would make a meaningful inquiry impossible. The commissions would be working in an impossible situation. The minister, the actions of whose ministry was to be reviewed by the public inquiry, would have the authority to thwart the efforts of the inquiry at every step. It really creates an intolerable Alice in Wonderland situation. While the chairman of the US Joint Committee on Human Rights, Congressman Chris Smith, declared that the bill pending before the British Parliament should be named the Public Inquiry's Cover-Up Bill. So if this new act makes inquiries so pointless and so easy to control, the question is why Blair, Clark and the rest of them have seemingly done their best to prevent one happening. We suggest that there will be an inquiry. It will be obstructed from the beginning, and it will be controlled by the very people it should be investigating. Be assured it will not be anything approaching a proper investigation. At no point will the inquiry even consider the possibility that the four men labelled as suicide bombers could possibly be innocent, or question the lack of evidence against them. It will pass on verbatim the same meaningless, unverifiable assertions made by the police and by the media's anonymous security sources. But it will avoid completely the major contradictions and problems in the official story. They hope at the end of it, the public will be satisfied. And the public probably will be.
Now, Richard, do you think if there is an inquiry into the London bombings, do you think the public will be satisfied, or will this just muddy the waters further?
If there is an inquiry into the 7/7 bombings, will that muddy the waters further?
Whether the inquiry system is robust enough
to... Is it adequate to supervise an inquiry? Well, most people, including, for example, Amnesty International, the Human Rights Commission, Irish, I think it's called the Irish-British Watch, Judge Corey, the Canadian judge, which has been consulted pretty much a high-up official judge, maybe even Savile himself, Lord Norton, or I should have said Chief Justice Savile, and a consistent number of people that I could quote for example, good points that you might also need to mention by Baroness Ashton of Holland. She's made pretty much a lot of statements on behalf of the government, so it's only fair to obviously include what she says. And they say that because the Savile inquiry has taken so long, and because it's so costly, and that's £200 million, that one of the incentives for creating the new 2005 Act is to make it more accountable in that sense, so it will be more cost effective, and also to limit the time that it takes for an inquiry, so time can be stipulated and cost. So that's a valid point, given that the Savile's inquiry is so expensive. We have to obviously say that. And there's a number of points that she makes in conjunction with the criticisms against the Act. Well, I could go through them on paper here. Well, I just mentioned one of them by saying that Dr. Robert Kay notes that it's striking that the new Act does not contain the requirement of the 1921 Act or legislation. For a resolution in Parliament, one of the chief functions of the legislature is to hold the executive to account, and in the 1921 Act that was allowed. Under the new Act, public inquiries into government are conducted for government and report to government. So obviously you're not going to get...
That's a very inquiry. Important point. I mean, the inquiry, the original Inquiries Act was from 1925 that you're mentioning there.
Yeah, and also other learned people, judges and members of the legislation of this country have commented that whilst in principle, the principle of the inquiry has to remain as moral and as ethical as possible, the management of an inquiry shouldn't deter the actual length of time and cost that it might take to inquire into something. In other words, so there's an argument there, you see.
If you think back, Richard, to the Franks inquiry into the Falklands War, that was carried out under the old rules, and it was a report to Parliament, not to government. And in actual fact, no stone was unturned. So we found out about the removal of the Endeavour, which had encouraged the Argentinians to believe that Britain no longer wanted to keep the Falkland Islands. There was a bit of obfuscation about the sinking of the General Belgrano. But if you compare the thoroughness of that inquiry and also the fact that Lord Carrington resigned as the minister, saying, "I was responsible for policy on that day, I resigned," that's like another era. We've now got what you might call fixed inquiries, which are reporting to government for government, and which are basically designed to cover up the truth. So the Chilcot inquiry has been, the Blair and so on have been treated with kid gloves.
And on that point, the Joint Committee of Human Rights has expressed its concern by saying that certain aspects of the Inquiries Act 2005 risked compromising the independence of the inquiry by potentially breaching Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, where the subject matter of the inquiry in that case would have been right to life.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we think about the Hutton inquiry, that was brought in order to prevent a coroner's inquest, which was the normal rules for any kind of death like that. There should have been a coroner's inquest. And immediately Tony Blair stood up and said, "Oh, we will deal with this, we will have an inquiry." So the coroner's inquest is cancelled. Somebody gets killed on the Bristol Ring Road, you have a coroner's inquest, but not in this case. And this whole inquiry system that's being brought in seems to be designed almost to cover up state malfeasance.
Well, there seems to be two major problems, don't there? There's first of all this idea that the government themselves should have a hand in deciding who is on the inquiry panel seems extremely...
That's right, it's not the judiciary.
..extremely dangerous. And secondly, the idea of having hearings in secret. I mean, the whole point of an inquiry is so that people who are affected by an incident such as the 7/7 London bombings, the families, the survivors, victims' families, etc., can rest easy that the truth is now out about what happened, and that everybody that has something to contribute to see having witnessed something or whatever can have their say at the public inquiry. The other thing is, for those that don't know, is that the idea of a public inquiry is that if there were multiple deaths and you were to have separate inquests, this would be extremely painful for people to have to relive the experience over and over again, because several witnesses would probably have to be at all the different separate inquests. Anyhow, one of the things that is also in this film Ludicrous Diversion about the lack of a public inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings is a little section where they deal with what can we do. Because so let's have a listen to that, and then afterwards see what you two have got to say about what you think we can do about the fact that this new Inquiries Act seems to be quite a big step back rather than a step forward when it comes to getting to the bottom of big political incidents, at least potentially political incidents.
So given that there's never going to be a real investigation determined to actually find rather than hide the truth, what can we do ourselves to uncover the facts? First, demand that the police release the evidence they say they've got. How? File a Freedom of Information request for the CCTV footage that they claim to have but have never released, and for the vast archive of CCTV images that they've never mentioned but must exist if the men took the journey we've been told they did. There is absolutely no reason for us not to see this CCTV footage, other than it not actually existing. Secondly, write to whatever mainstream media you read or watch and ask them why they have not addressed the verifiable mistruth that they have themselves put out about the attacks. Why they have not questioned the obvious discrepancies in the narrative or the contradictions in the police's presentations of the facts. And why they appear to be actively supporting the police and the government over the British public in suppressing information whilst releasing disinformation. And thirdly, write to your Member of Parliament. Ask him if he has read the official narrative and what his views are on the obvious contradictions it contains. Then ask him, as your elected representative, to demand answers from Parliament concerning this attack on the British people. If the official story is right, if the narrative describes the events the way they actually happened, then there is no justification for the police refusing your requests. There is no reason the media would not be properly investigating the details of the official narrative, and there is no reason for your MP to be anything other than open and helpful. But at best, their response to you will be a light disinterest. That's if you get a response. And the information requested, the evidence crucial for any of us to make an informed judgment about what happened that day, will not be forthcoming. Don't believe us? Try it.
I think it's also important, just to round up on this, that we mentioned the Resolution 740, which condemned the Inquiries Act 2005, because it does not represent, because it represents a very rare example of US Congress formally criticizing a British Act of Parliament. So it's very unusual for that to have occurred. The above resolution was agreed by a majority of 390-5 on the 18th of May 2006, and that the 390 in favour consisted of 200 Republicans and 189 Democrats.
So the US Congress actually voted to, in some way, condemn anyway this change in the law in Britain.
Yeah, it's very important to recognise that fact, and it's a very rare example of US Congress formally criticising a British Act of Parliament.
Okay, Richard, I'd like, just like to hear from you. What do you think we can do? I mean, if there's anybody, for example, people with relatives involved in some big incident, and that they're not looking forward to having an inquiry under the 2005 Act, what on earth can people do?
Well, that's a question I haven't actually prepared for, but
I think, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why can't we go back to the rules as they previously existed, which is a judicial inquiry independent of the government, and when you set one up, people know that that's what's going to happen. I mean, the Franks inquiry was pretty free and fair in its assessment of the mistakes that had been made in the run-up to the Falklands War, which Richard was a participant in. I mean, why can't we just go back to the old system? Why are we inventing a new system, which is a crummy system, which gives the government the right to judge itself, which is obviously, you know, a farce and a travesty?
Good question. Right.
The other thing that has to be mentioned is that we have not just the Pat Finucane case to deal with, and the obvious murders that have taken place in Northern Ireland, but if those things had not happened, this act would still nevertheless concern people, because we've got other acts, other inquiries to make in the future under this act. So we could include failures of public services, deaths in prisons or rail disasters, army deaths in disputed circumstances.
Anything that embarrasses the government.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it also has to be said, doesn't it, surely, that the government must have in some way the ace up the sleeve to control things, possibly in for the benefit of national security to some extent.
I would agree with that, but at the same time, you've got to have some transparency, and there's got to be a rule of law. I mean, if the government is breaking the law, then we need to know, don't we?
Well, the government is making the law.
If the government makes the law in a transparent way, and we all know what's going on, that's one thing. But if things are going on behind the scenes that we're not being told, well, that's something else, isn't it?
Another interesting comment was made by Helen Shaw, co-director of Inquest Charity, which is a charitable event organisation, I should say, Inquest, in which she noted that in October 2008 and again in May 2009, government proposals to create a new category of secret inquests in the Counter-Terrorism Bill and the Coroners and Justice Bill were withdrawn following a hail of protests, because essentially if gun law, in terms of gun law, inquests as inquest transparency is essential now that the armed police are to patrol the streets of London more often.
Well, one of the things that the effects that this has, Martin, is that it really kind of lowers the people's trust in the rule of law, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, why are the government bringing in an Inquiries Act which is favourable to government? Well, you have to ask yourself that question, don't you? It's because they're up to stuff and they don't want us to know about it.
So, you know, what does the Inquiries Act mean in reality? Does it mean, for example, that it would allow inquests to be scrapped in favour of secret inquiries under this legislation by ministers to suit their political objectives?
We saw that happen in Hutton, where a coroner's inquest was cancelled, which might have shown that Dr. David Kelly was murdered, in favour of an inquiry which turned out to be a whitewash.
OK, well, thanks ever so much for that report, Richard, and let's hope that there is some common sense prevails, and that maybe the old public inquiry system can be used in future when looking into these particular incidents where potentially the government could be incriminated themselves.
Just to round up, a lot of people are suggesting that this act, the 2005 Act, be repealed and replaced with something more sensible, you know, going back to 1921. And there's a list here which I could mention, but it includes Judge Corrie, obviously, Amnesty International, British, Irish, Rights Watch, the Committee for the Administration of Justice, Human Rights First, and all the other people that I've mentioned in the last 5 or 10 minutes in conjunction with this are all obviously saying the same thing. It should be scrapped.
Okay, thanks very much for your report. Now let's have a little bit of music before the end of the show. Garbage and Stupid Girl from 1999. Apologies for not being able to bring you a report about John Wick, the guy behind the expenses crisis. We'll have that one next week. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up very soon is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where via our Barton Hill transmitter we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. And we bring you the city's top investigative reports. If you want us to look into a story, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Cabot Ward and Chair of the Central Planning Committee, Alex Woodman. Thanks also to our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin Summers, and Marina Morris for this week's report and Vox Pop, and also Richard Cowley for the report into the 2005 Inquiries Act. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, Cabinet Member for Children and Young People and Lib Dem Councillor for Henleys, Claire Campion-Smith, will be here to help us review the news. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all previous Friday Drive Times, including my hour-long report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, as well as the investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose at bcfm.org.uk. Up next, it's Somali language programming with Nemo and Somali Youth. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.